lot more. How could she not have known? And if she did, how could the woman I trusted with my life set me up? I was terrified. I had fallen into a backward, fucked up world. I called my management agency. The man who answered was a player, a powerful guy in town at the time. I told him what happened to me. And he said, God damn it. I just had an expose about him killed in the LA Times. He owes it to me not to do this. Oh my God. This man could have stopped this monster from hurting me, but instead chose to do him a solid? It's okay, right? I was just a girl. My brain was stunned into silence. Who were these awful people? I wanted to press charges. Someone connected me with a brusque female criminal attorney who said, You are an actress. You've done a sex scene. You'll never win. You're done. I went cold all over. I was alone. I was all alone. I knew if I came out publicly with this, nothing was going to happen to the monster, but I would never work again. If I lost work, I wouldn't be able to support myself, and once again, I was terrified of being homeless. No work would land me back on the streets, and homelessness was a death sentence. I knew if I died, I'd be remembered for revealing my rapist, but not for my achievements. I didn't want his name next to mine in my obituary. I thought a lot about death during this time. Mine. His. And everything felt dirty in my world. I got a call from the head of my then law firm. I had to tell him the truth once again, feeling violated by sharing a deep, open wound with some industry creep I didn't even know, which felt violating in and of itself. The big lawyer urged, I really want you to publicly come out against the studio head. It would be a great thing to do. But it wouldn't be a great thing to do. As battered as my spirit was, I instinctively knew that I would become a minor player in some kind of power game between two powerful men. Thanks for nothing. Even in my traumatized state, I realized that even this powerful man couldn't do anything that would help me. Maybe if there's enough of an incentive, a financial or political win, they might consider breaching the honor code that protects these fuckers. But probably not. As it turned out, no one did. Not for 20 years. Because it's okay. It's the business. And it is just a girl. So I knew better than to say anything. I was not going to be used as a pawn by these people. Even in my messed up state, I refused to be a pawn. I didn't realize yet that I already was one. I was so disgusted. I'd worked so hard my whole life trying to survive. I'd already been groped, grabbed at, hollered at, diminished, fetishized, but this was a whole other level of violation. Traumatically, I had to go back to work and finish Phantoms as I was in the middle of filming when I fatefully went to Sundance. I played a 16-year-old in the film, but now I felt like I was around 100 years old. I was so disgusted with Hollywood, but I was under contract and I had to finish. I had to hear his pig name every day over and over and over. So what could I, a young powerless woman, do? I wanted to put him on notice that I was not okay with what he did. I was pretty broke still. I said to my attorney, I'm going to need money for intensive therapy, and I'm going to need money to donate to a rape crisis center. My lawyer got me $100,000. That money felt dirty anyway. I largely gave it away. It brought me no solace. But it was the only way I could put the pig on notice that I was not okay at all with what he did. I started to hear rumblings around town, snippets here and there. The monster was blacklisting me. I heard he called every other studio, an independent producer in town, and said, Don't hire her. She's bad news. So many people heard about what had happened. It had spread like wildfire through Hollywood. One assistant tells another assistant, one producer tells another producer, and on and on. It seemed like every creep in Hollywood knew about my most vulnerable and violated moment, and I was the one who was punished for it. It's like being assaulted over and over and over. People think that you can get over being assaulted. The thing with trauma and rape and sexual assault is that it freezes in your mind as if it happened yesterday. It's very, very hard to get rid of because a large part of you, the you that was whole, has been murdered. I've come to a certain peace with it, but my life will always be irrevocably tied to this monster because of what he stole from me. Because his desire to dominate superseded my right to bodily integrity, my right to be whole. Sexual assault takes away our ability to be who we were and steals who we were meant to be. Now we victims are cast in a role we didn't want to play. Girls grow up being terrified of rape because it's allowed to happen. Girls are told in health class, just like I was, that it's best to submit and be pliant. That way you can live. Yeah, my body might be alive, but who I was is dead. I'm now a live body carrying a deadened spirit around, and it's allowed to go unpunished. Everyone just wants it to go away so they can feel better. But what about us? How do we feel better? Who cares for us? Don't you dare teach us girls to be pliant. Teach your boys not to rape. To me, rape cannot be defined by a law a man wrote. How would that man know what rape is? Rape to me is any violation of my body. If you enter my body via tongue, fingers, penis, object without my consent, that to me is rape, and I need no law telling me what I know to be true. I wanted to go back to before when I was a whole person. I wanted to go back to being a strong badass, but I was now in a million pieces. I couldn't stop crying. I couldn't stop the screaming nightmares. I couldn't stop Hollywood. I just wanted out and away. My body kept having its own flashbacks. The premiere. After 2 hours of being turned into a plastic doll-like version of myself, I get driven in a very cold, air-conditioned car to the red carpet. As I get closer, I can hear the people on the sidewalk screaming. My stress level is going through the roof. My hands shake. My legs shake. I know I'm going to participate in a massacre of sorts by opening myself up to being bullied on a global level. That's really what it translates to. It's not so much, oh, let's go celebrate the opening of this project that I worked on, but more about getting savaged by trolls online for daring to exist. I know that whatever photos are taken of me today will be on stupid gossip sites and magazines. They're going to say nasty things about me on all the message boards. I know this is going to happen, but here I am anyway, getting ready to pose. I feel nauseated. I hate this. I step out of the car and smile, a ridiculous expression on my face that in photographs reads strangely. Sometimes I'd even laugh out of sheer hysteria. I have to wait with my publicist to signal me for my turn to walk the gauntlet, aka the red carpet. The celebrities having their photos taken are staggered so you're not in front of the cameras at the same time. I'm shaking harder now because of the yelling and the noise, and I can feel my knee twitching and bouncing underneath my uncomfortable gown. It's now my turn. In little mincing steps, my stupid high heels are already killing my feet. My fake eyelashes are heavy every time I blink, and with voluminous hair that's puffed out to God knows where, I make my way to the first photographer. It's usually anywhere from 10 to 100 photographers, mostly men, screaming, raging, yelling your name as loud as they can to get attention. My body absorbing their yelling is aggression. Mince, mince, mince. 3 steps down, stop, hand on hip, smile, flash, repeat. The photographer's yelling, over the shoulder, because that way they can get both my ass and my face in the shot. I do what I'm asked to do, and I turn. There, now you have my ass too. I've done my job. This part of my job entails being a piece of meat to be consumed and savaged and judged. Fun times. Now I've successfully made it to the end of the photographer's line, and I move on to TV press like Entertainment Tonight or Extra, shows that glorify banality. Their cameras pan up and down my body. They asked me to turn around, and once again, like the good brainwashed girl I am, I oblige. I do a slow twirl, feeling ridiculous, not knowing I could have said no. Hollywood thinks this is normal. They started it. But it's not normal. They've just spread the diseased idea of beauty to the world. And I am part of that disease. On the big screen, I see my name. I see my face moving, and all I can concentrate on is my teeth. My small nose looks giant. I didn't know I had that one wrinkle. I didn't know that my voice sounded so much like my sister's. Oh shit, here comes the topless scene. I feel a strange shame wash over me. Not because I'm naked, but because of how I'm interpreted by the men doing the interpreting. Circus life. I was so sick of working. I'd worked to survive since I was a child, at any job I could possibly get, and I'd never had any period where I didn't have to worry, like stomach and knots worry. When I was little, I heard kids in school talk about going on vacation. Once I figured out what they meant by vacation, I started thinking about what my dream vacation would look like. I decided mine would be a week in a hospital where no one could hurt me and I could have all the pudding I wanted. And right about then, it was all I wanted. Pudding and no one hurting me. My angel dogs, Bug and Fester, were my lifesavers during this time. They were what got me up in the morning. I had to tend to them. I couldn't wallow in my sadness. I hated how I was feeling after the assault. There was some good news around the corner, though, quite literally. In the year leading up to our meeting, a huge rock star had a meteoric rise, and his name was Marilyn Manson. I was quite unaware of what was going on in popular culture because I'd been so deeply absorbed into the world of movies. As far as Marilyn Manson went, I remember seeing a couple of photos of him in makeup and thinking, he is the ugliest person I've ever seen. But simultaneously, I thought it was kind of cool that he was willing to be that ugly. Then one night, I was at this absurd restaurant in New York, an S&M restaurant of all ridiculous things, where you had to choose what kind of abuse you wanted while you ate. The whole place was dark, so you didn't even know what you were eating, which, as a picky Virgo, was not my thing. Seating control in exchange for food seemed silly, and I was trying not to laugh out loud. Some people were in cages, and the waiter said I could go in, too. I settled on letting him rub my feet. The waiter rubbing my feet said to me, "My friend Brian has a crush on you." "Oh, that's nice," he went on. "I'm from Ohio. We knew each other back home." "Oh, okay, that's nice," he said. "It's Marilyn Manson." And I said, "Oh, that's the ugly guy." He was taken aback. He said, "Yes, but he has a huge crush on you." I said, "Okay, well, that's nice." Then one night, shortly after that, and back in L.A., I was on my way to a screening of the seminal indie movie Gummo. I was late, and I had to bang on the screening room doors to be let in. I knocked again, and finally, this guy who looked like a cross between an 18th century dandy and Ichabod Crane opened it. I looked right at him, recognized him as Marilyn Manson. I smiled and said, "Hey, I hear you have a crush on me." I didn't think he was ugly in person. I thought he was incredibly unique looking. We were pretty much together from that moment on. For the record, you call him Manson. Anybody who would later come up and say, "How's Marilyn?" I would know immediately they didn't know him, or they would say, "How's Brian?" trying to make it seem like they knew who he was because they knew his real name. We had so much fun. We truly did. But still, I was plagued with night terrors and post-traumatic stress disorder. The first year we were together, Manson patched me back together after the assault. I didn't tell him what had happened for the first few months, but finally he asked a girlfriend of mine, "What's wrong with Rose?" I was waking up screaming at night, soaking the sheets with my night sweats. My friend told him the truth, and Manson was so sweet with me. Finally, some kindness. He was a very misunderstood person. Even though the media had dealt with controversial musicians like Alice Cooper or Ozzy Osbourne and rational people knew it was all about art performance, with Manson they really bought it. They really thought he spent his nights skinning puppy dogs alive and boiling them in vats of acid while saying, "Hail Satan." In reality, the exact opposite was going on. The truth was that at the time when he wasn't creating electrifying music, Manson was painting watercolors of my Boston Terriers while I was ordering glassware from Martha Stewart's online store. We basically hid out from the world at home, totally domestic, when we weren't on the road having mad escapades. I was happy because I could forget about what happened to me, at least during the day. Nevertheless, people thought it was bizarre that I was going out with him. When they freaked out about it, I'd think, but you're bizarre to me. This is somebody who's kind to me, who's taking care of me. Manson always saw to my needs and paid great attention to detail, and we fell in love. When I ran off with the Manson Circus, I didn't really work for about 3.5 years. We had to worry about death threats and bomb threats and being terrorized online, but at least I didn't have to worry about where my next meal was coming from because I'd saved up some money from acting. It was a blast, and we were madly in love, and anybody else who thinks differently is wrong. It was a pretty legendary relationship, not just in the media. It was a pretty legendary relationship behind the scenes, too. We had a whole lot of amazing. Unfortunately, it seems his manager, his bandmates, and his whiny friend Billy were telling Manson things to the effect of, "Rose is making you look soft. Going out with an actress is making you look like a pussy." Since when is the long tradition of actresses and rock stars going out together a bad thing? Whatever. Male jealousy is a strange and stupid thing. Manson likes yes people around him. I've never been a yes person. I knew there were going to be serious career repercussions for me going out with Manson. People already didn't know what to do with me because I was unique, because I wasn't the girl next door. I was told that by a lot of casting directors. "You're not the girl next door." You know who was? A blonde Reese Witherspoon type. So apparently, everyone who has a female neighbor better make sure she looks like a sweet blonde who never offends. The first 5 months I went out with Manson, I kept it very much on the down low because I didn't want to be known as his accessory. I eventually got brave enough and decided, you love who you love. This is it. I braced myself and came out and took the slings and arrows from the world. Boy, did I take some hits. The squares were after me, mainstream media in a tizzy. Sometimes messing with the public was fun. I love subversion. I have an impish sense of humor. Hollywood is filled with nervous little biddies in the shape of men and women. They're such scaredy cats. They're scared of their own shadows. They're scared of anything different, anything unique. Manson terrified them. When I'd see how these producers reacted when they saw Manson, I'd think to myself, you're in the entertainment business. What part of entertainment do you not get? A few years ago, long after we split up, I was at a dinner with 10 male agents from the powerhouse Hollywood agency, CAA. If there's one thing I really loathe, it's these guys. The agents are such douchebags and have incredibly delusional senses of self-worth. They make the list for who gets hired and pushed and who doesn't. One of the agents, think an older frat dude in a $3,000 suit, turned to me and asked one of the questions that most annoys me. "Why'd you go out with that freak, Marilyn?" Before he could even get his offensive question out, I stood up. I walked to the head of the table. I put my hands on it. I leaned forward. I looked each one in the eye and I said, "Gentlemen, let me give you some truth. The second you can make a child feel less alone, the second you can move somebody to tears, the second you can make somebody feel, think, and live through you by being a creative, by being an artist, the second you can do that, you can discuss why I went out with somebody who is more creative in his little pinky than you will ever be in your goddamn boring life with your fucked up value system and your bloated ego that is not warranted for any fucking reason that I can discern. Alone in the dark at the end of your life, you will be an empty suit in a coffin. You will leave nothing and be nothing. Good night, gentlemen." I stand by my words. Even if Hollywood was scared of Manson, he obviously deeply affected many people. One time, I remember standing on the side of the stage, looking out over 350,000 people, this human wave of an audience, while Manson sang a song called Coma White, which was a song about my life, my story. There's something cold and blank behind her smile. Yes, there was something definitely cold and blank behind my smile. She's standing on an overpass in her Miracle Mile. I lived in the Miracle Mile section of LA when we first met. He goes on to sing in that particular song about taking pills to make yourself numb and dumb, but how all the drugs in this world wouldn't save you from yourself. At the time, I'd started taking medication for my overwhelming depression and panic attacks after the assault. It was a uniquely strange sensation to hear all these people singing along to lyrics that were about my life story, even though they didn't know it. Touring was both fun and banal. It was especially hard encountering groupies subjugating themselves and letting themselves be used and abused by the guys in the band and the crew just for the sake of being closer to someone famous. At every stop of the tour I was on, women were lining up to submit themselves to abuse. Wash, rinse, repeat. One of the guys in the band would zero in on overweight girls, spend all night with them, and propose marriage. Then he'd never call them again, and do it the next night. I bet these girls have histories of personal abuse, of being valued only for one thing, and they think that by being with someone famous, or having a rock star pay them any attention, their lives are going to change. In the face of that, to keep my pro-woman stance alive was a bit of a challenge, but I did. I didn't know enough yet to know that the system is flawed because of men. It was also lonely. Manson and I would be holed up in the back of the tour bus watching The Big Lebowski for the 60th time, while the other guys would be in the front of the bus or hotel doing whatever it was they did. Manson was quite shy at the time, and the guys were nice to me, but grudgingly and only if Manson was around. He didn't mingle much in the public, so I wasn't in danger of groupie girls coming after him. But a lot of the fangirls online hated me because I occupied a space they imagined themselves filling. It inspired a lot of rage towards me, just for existing. On the Hollywood side, I had these idiots thinking I boil cats. Then on the public side, these girls hating me for being with someone they fantasized about. Fun times. I used to think, what's the upside in all of this? Well, the upside is that we stuck together. We were like a unit. And he did put on an incredible show. I loved dancing on the side of the stage because the band could rock the house down. Once on my birthday, Manson took me to Italy, to the Tuscan countryside where I was born and raised. I was trying to find the stone barn I was born in on the Duke's property. There's Manson, all 138 pounds, 6 feet 3 inches, dressed in black, wearing big stomper shoes that made him 6'7", looking like a scarecrow with his hat and a leather jacket in the heat of Tuscany, walking over hillsides with me, looking like a deranged Easter egg in a long pink skirt with a yellow shirt, and Petey, his gigantic bodyguard, following closely behind. We huffed and puffed all over the hills trying to find the barn. At one point, this little kid on a tiny bike passed us and yelled out in his thick accent, "Aye, aye, Marilyn Manson!" It was surreal and hilarious. Eventually, we found the stone barn. The sister of the Duke of Zoagli now owned the property, Rosa Ariana, my namesake. When I presented myself on her doorstep, I worked up the courage to knock. She came out and started screaming at me in Italian to get off her property, trying to hit me with a broom. I laughed it off as we scurried away. But we found the barn I was born in. I was so touched by him taking me there. The first big event I went to with Manson was a little thing in 1998 called the MTV Video Music Awards. At that time, everyone tuned in to see what people were wearing and what the incredible moment would be, as well as what the acts were going to be doing on stage, who was going to say what, and what crazy music world stuff might happen. It was a really special time. Courtney Love and Hole were huge. Manson was the most controversial star in the world. There's some cool art going on in the mainstream. Thinking about my own red carpet moment, I figured, Manson's going to be really flamboyant for these awards. What the hell do I wear? And then I started to think about what I was going to wear in regard to how Hollywood and mainstream media would perceive me. I thought, you know what? Fuck you. You want to objectify me? You want to see a body? This is what you want? All you media men, all you photographers, you vultures, this is what you want to see? I'll fucking show you a body. And so I did. Wearing the naked dress, as I call it, was a big middle finger to pretty much everybody. It was a reclamation of my own body after my assault. I wanted to challenge the media to see how they would deal with it. You want me to be your show pony? I'll be your show pony. The infamous dress was sent to me the night before the event. The day of the MTV Awards, I had a 101-degree fever and was taking sinus medicine that made me loopy. On the way there, I had to be on my knees in the limo because otherwise the beading from the dress would have imprinted a waffle print on my backside, which would be more or less entirely exposed to the cameras. My heart was racing as we stepped out of the limo. I raised my arm up high and silently said, "Yes, bitches, I'm here." I changed right when I got off the red carpet into a different outfit, one that covered more. The dress raised hell, which I guess was my intention of sorts, but what I didn't anticipate was the global slut-shaming that came afterward. I didn't realize how seriously everyone would take it. Do these people not understand rebellion and humor? I thought, it's a music awards show. My dress was punk as fuck. This is what it's about. It was, of course, misinterpreted and sexualized, which was the exact opposite point I was trying to make. That's the thing the other women who have copied me have gotten wrong through the years. When they copy the dress, they do it to be sexy and turn society on. I didn't do it to be sexy. I did it with power. Not to titillate or turn on the boys and the men of the world. I did it as a big middle finger. And there's the difference. I think that's why it's become such an iconic thing. Every year, every time there's an award show, that picture of me pops back up. It was my first time having a big scandal, so to speak, a global one anyway. I say first time because I've done it several times since, but that one is the most physically memorable to people. For years, I was the actress who wore the dress. Regardless, it took some serious bravery to do that. I was scared. But I just did it anyway. Punk as fuck. At least I know when I'm 80, looking back on my history, I certainly won't identify as a scared person who didn't live. I'm from Europe. I'm not a freak about my body. American puritanical society shames you for daring to show any part of yourself, especially when it's done in a non-sexual manner. When a woman owns her body, she gets vilified. I was vilified for making people uncomfortable. Ever since then, I've had to deal with the slut-shaming that came from wearing that dress. I regretted it at times, and other times I just thought, fuck off. Now I don't regret it at all. It's my body. I can do what I want with it. But being a part of a media shitstorm is definitely a weird version of Mr. Toad's wild ride, and there's nothing that can prepare you for it. At the time, all the managers and agents were saying to both Manson and to me, you have to have a website about yourself and look at the message board to see what the fans want. That was before famous people understood it's treacherous, and you absolutely should not look at message boards. It's like Lord of the Flies. They pile on the defenseless and beat them with their negativity. Some of the vilest scum of humanity post on message boards. Bad people with bad energy. I guess now they're on all platforms. I can't imagine what these people are like in their real lives or why they have so much hate in their hearts. If you are one of them, know that you cause damage to other humans. So I dove into the message boards and went deep. I took a lot of things into my brain that would break most people. Most people can't handle hearing one bad thing said about them, let alone global bullying about your face, your body, your character. The enmity and the hatred for me was so intense. When you read nasty things about yourself, it sticks. You can have 30 compliments and one negative, and you remember the negative. It's human nature, right? Now imagine that times millions. It really messed with my head. Just know that if people are saying cruel things to you and about you, you can weather it. You will survive. If you can get to a place where you are okay marching to your own beat, you will thrive and be free. I promise you it gets better. It took me time to learn this. One day a supposed friend told me to check out this site online, so I did. It was a website devoted to how fat I was. I was shocked. It was page after page of me. In some pages, my dog's face was mixed with mine. In other ones, I was put on a cross with diagrams all over me pointing out how fat I was. It was really expertly done, and the crazy woman, yes, it was a woman who created it, could spell and use perfect grammar, so it really stuck in my head. Somehow it's easier to dismiss the people who write mean things when they can't even spell, like, you're a whore instead of you're a whore. When they can spell, it stings more. It was strange because the creator of this lovely site used a lot of the same terminology that I had used in my own head when I was at the height of my anorexia. I became quite thin again after that. It stuck in my brain that I was fat. It reactivated my eating disorder. It fucked me up. Constantly hearing about how ugly you are, then seeing that every photo of you has been retouched or photoshopped, you lose sight completely of what you look like. I just thought at one point, I must look like Quasimodo. It went beyond skin deep. I was starting to lose all sense of who I was and what I was. The trolling continued. When a loser named Perez Hilton started putting me on his, at the time, hugely popular website, he was merciless. He'd draw me with penises coming out of my mouth and semen all over my face. He said horrible things about everyone, but particularly women. He's definitely a woman hater. He would call Jennifer Aniston, Maniston, and think that he was deep with wit. Wow, sir, you are the next Oscar Wilde. Look at you go. I always wonder if these dirtbags, after they're done for the day, tearing other humans down, do they go home and, woo, that was a hard day's work, drawing dicks on someone's face, I feel really good about myself. There's a saying, a loose statistic, that one fan letter equals 5,000 actual fans, because only one out of that many is going to take the trouble to actually sit down and write a fan letter. So then when there are 1,000 vicious comments, you really start wondering about society. To the creeps out there in the public, the ones who take the time to write the nasty things, rest assured knowing that you contribute to the breaking down of a person. Congratulations. Go you. Your contribution to the world is duly noted. Reverse course. More recently, I was on NPR, and I was curious whether the comments on their website would be more highbrow, more articulate. Nope. It was mostly a bunch of white dudes freaking out because I called them on their male privilege. It is so obvious. It's amazing when they refuse to acknowledge it. It is indefensible and true. And even on NPR's website, the trolls incorrectly taunt, you're a whore. Y-O-U-R, a whore. People say that well-known people are worshipped, but I don't really see that. I see the horrible tearing down. You take these hits just for daring to exist on a larger stage than others. But why is that my fault? I'm not asking for deification. I'm just asking for simple respect for being someone whose only crime is being visible. All we are doing is being of service to you. There's also this conflated belief that if someone is perceived to have money, that person must have no problems and therefore it's okay to tear the person down. Almost all well-known people, minus those who are there through nepotism, come from humble backgrounds, and we worked our asses off to get to where we are. So back the fuck up. Fame is like you suddenly moved into the tiniest town in the world with all the small town gossips doing their best to shame the local girl they deem loose. Just like in tiny towns, the gossips sit in their homes and peer out their curtains and track your every move, flaunting their precious bits of intel, exchanging it with others like shaming is a valuable currency. She didn't go to church on Sunday. She must be a whore. Being a well-known person is the same kind of thing. It's just on a very big scale. If you yearn to be famous, think on it long and hard, because it is most definitely not all that in a bag of chips. It is a hard life for the mind. It is about so much more than you can possibly know, and it's all meaningless at the same time. A natural-born mindfuck. Remember what I was telling you about cults? Well, small-town cult mentality is the same as Hollywood's. The only difference is that Hollywood is filling the minds of the small-town gossips, giving them their belief systems. Back to Manson times. In April 1999, the first mass shooting at an American school had just happened. A violent tragedy at a school called Columbine. Two murderers in the first televised high school shooting went on a rampage. When it was going down, and those poor kids were being held hostage by the killers, all anyone knew was that the bad guys were wearing black clothing. CNN and other news networks immediately started putting out pictures of Manson, saying the shooters were Satan worshippers and fans of Marilyn Manson, all while a hostage situation was in play. In their manifesto, the killers actually wrote about how much they hated Manson. They thought he was weak. But in the media, the damage was done. CNN, Fox, all those places, trying to throw any garbage on the screen in the absence of coverage because they couldn't get inside the school building, put Manson's face on screen, and he became deeply intertwined with that horribly tragic day. After Columbine, Manson started to receive death threats and bomb threats, and by association, so did I. Manson's part-time security became full-time. The public at large was something scary and to be kept away from. The blame wore on him. All this enmity, hatred, and rage. I'm so protective of the people I'm with, and it became almost a full-time job being with him. It didn't leave me time to think about myself, which was both a positive and negative. Looking at the past, I can see why I did what I did. It was the programming that is given to us as girls from the first. The programming that says men's careers are more important than ours. I tended to go out with powerful men who treated my career like a hobby, whereas theirs was the real deal. I think a lot of women do this too. I hope you look at your own life and recognize whether you are minimizing it, because I did. I hope you don't. Know that your work is equal, even if your pay is not. I wish I'd been able to see my strengths earlier, but I wasn't aware enough yet. Eventually, I grew exhausted. The circus that saved me was now burning me out. I was really in love with Manson. I just couldn't do the lifestyle anymore. I was too tired. I didn't ask Manson for any money. I didn't take anything other than the furniture I'd already owned. After we broke up in 2001, Manson went on Howard Stern and trashed me badly. I was so shocked. This was a man I'd nicknamed Doctor, because if I even looked like I had a headache, he'd say, "Do you need aspirin? Tylenol? Are you okay? Can I help you?" He was so considerate of me, so gentle. But he became someone who had this vendetta, and it was nasty, hurting me badly. He always acted like he was so different, but in the end, behaved like a typical cisgendered male, that is, harassing the defenseless woman because his man ego is hurt. Wah, poor little baby. How about you grow up, boys? That attitude leads to our death. We can die in many ways. It's not just the body. After the breakup, I resurfaced in Hollywood. Because I had to make money, I felt as if I had to go on a campaign of, "See, America? I'm not that scary." I had to do that just to survive, because what other kind of job was I going to get at this point? I was infamously famous. I was stuck. And I knew I was being blacklisted in the film community by my assaulter. So what were my options? On set. I wake up Monday at 4:15 a.m. Is it the morning or the night? I'm not sure. I only know being up this late early makes me nauseated. The night before, I memorized all my lines, around 10 pages of dense dialogue. It is tedious going, the words on top of words on top of words. All varying just slightly from the day before make it difficult for me to remember. I have dreams that I forget all my lines and everyone just stares at me in silent expectation. I am continually stressed I won't remember my lines. Each day that I don't forget them feels like a huge victory. Time is definitely money on film sets, and any time I mess up, I can feel the stress of the assistant director and producers, which makes me more nervous. Everything hinges on us actors not fucking up. I drive in the dark to set and arrive. I'm immediately followed by a production assistant with a walkie who radios out that I've arrived. He follows me to the hair and makeup trailer. They follow me everywhere all the time, those guys with the headsets and walkies, as if I'm not capable of walking from point A to point B. I step into the trailer, and my eyes adjust to the bright lights. The blow dryers are already going, but even so, I can still hear my co-star screech talking in her baby talk voice. I put my earplugs in to block the cringe-inducing sound, but I can still hear her squawk. I hate baby talk unless there is a baby involved. My makeup artist remarks that I must have slept well because the skin under my eyes is puffy. She tells me every day how much better I look when I don't sleep. I stare at myself, and my under-eye bags look not too hideous. But if she says they're bad, it must be true, I guess. I hate sitting and looking at myself in the mirror. I think it's unnatural to have to constantly stare at your own face with a critical eye. I stare, trying to recognize the person staring back, because this is where I morph into another woman, not myself. The fucking baby talk is still screeching, and I shudder. I get sent over to the hair chair, and the blow dryer begins its 45-minute job. I have a lot of hair. The hairstyle I'm being given has to match the picture of what was filmed the day before. I read over my lines on my mini script. Yep, they're just as banal as I remembered. I'm finally done with my transformation. I survey the finished work. I'll get to be myself again in 12 hours. Until then, I have to be someone else, a passenger in my own body. Funny thing, actors, a lot of them, we spend a lot more time living in trailer homes than most people would imagine. The lifestyle is not as glamorous as you might think. The tedium can be oppressive. Take filming, for example. Imagine the scene is you having coffee with a friend, just the two of you sitting there in a coffee shop. That two-person scene will take about 4 hours to shoot, if not more. You need the master shot of the entire scenario. Then you go in closer. That's a medium shot. And then we find our heroes. Now there's a medium close-up of the hero, and then a tighter close-up. After that side is complete, the camera turns around to the other side and repeats. It's a lot of work. You say the words over and over and over again from every possible angle, and that's just one take. You have to do many more takes on top of that. I'm not complaining, I'm explaining. You start getting very, very tired around 4 p.m. because you've been up since around 4:30 a.m. You cram in memorization for the next day's work. The day wraps up and you go home at 7 p.m. if it's a good day. Often it's around 9 p.m. The 9 p.m. means you have what's called a turnaround. You have to have 12 hours in between shooting times legally, but there's something called forced calls where they can make you come in after a 10-hour turnaround. That's what usually happens. Now you have about an hour or so to be awake and be yourself. You look at your lines again before bed, wash your face, pass out, get up, start the whole thing over again. Televised life. I was in Romania when I got a phone call from Aaron Spelling, a legendary TV producer, famous for a slew of wildly successful, if cheesy, shows like The Love Boat and Dynasty and 90210. He told me about a show called Charmed that had been on for 3 seasons. It was about good witches who helped protect the world from evil. There had been a major cast shakeup. Shannon Doherty, the show's main star, was leaving the show, and they were writing in a new character. Would I consider playing a role on television? I didn't know what Charmed was, but I was curious. On the flight home from Romania, the pilot episode of Charmed was available to watch. I have never seen Charmed offered on a plane since then, just that one flight. It felt like kismet. I'd been looking for a sign, and there it was. I thought the pilot episode was pretty cool, so I agreed to meet and talk. It felt nice to be wanted after so much rejection and knowing I was blacklisted by my omnipresent monster. The bigwig's office on Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles was like a football field of deep white shag rug, so deep I couldn't see my high heels. A tiny little man, probably about 5 feet tall, was sitting behind a big desk, attended by his butler in tails. This was the legendary Aaron Spelling. It was wild because I used to love watching Dynasty with my mother when I was little, and here I was now with the head honcho. The butler brought Mr. Spelling this big crystal goblet of blue Gatorade with a bent straw and a silver tray. I'll always remember that. I imagined the conversation with Spelling. I like a bent straw. I just love that. He was a sweet man. I didn't dislike him. In fact, I thought he was kind of cute. The whole time I was in the meeting, I was imagining him with blue troll doll hair. That's what I often did so I wouldn't be nervous. I started to speak and noticed Mr. Spelling looking at me like I was part alien, and so did the couple of other executives who were in the meeting. That always happened everywhere I went in Hollywood. I think it was because the way I looked and the way I spoke were two very different things. Meaning I looked like a stylized bombshell, but definitely did not speak like one. People in Hollywood and the media world really did not know what to make of me. Instead of seeing me as an artist in mind, they put me in the bad girl category. They couldn't seem to hear a fucking word that came out of my mouth because they were too fucking stupid. Tedious. I'm like the most patient, impatient person in the world. I was fine with being known as a rebel, but worldwide condemnation of you for being a bad girl will seep into your head. Plus, the "you're bad" thing triggered a lot of my father's earlier words and made them echo in my head. The old fear of being homeless, being helpless, began to creep back. I was scared of television because I'd heard that hours were brutal and I didn't know anything about that world. I barely watched TV, but it was a job. There was about to be an actor's strike in Hollywood. I knew there might not be work for the next 2 years. I started to think seriously about doing the show. My movie blacklisting was still hanging over me. It felt violating that so many industry people knew of my trauma, but sided with my perpetrator. Years had passed since I had last had regular work in Hollywood, and I was only 28. I remember being embarrassed on my birthday because Entertainment Tonight announced my age. I felt ashamed. That's how fucked up my brain was. The messaging that you get from society, media, and Hollywood skews age-related thinking. Back then, I thought it was just because young women were more beautiful, but now I realize that it's because a young woman is typically more docile, often easily manipulated, and too easily tricked into doing what the man wants, both societally and individually. Fuck that. Funny how when we come into our own power as women, that's exactly when we are considered unattractive. It is they who are unattractive. So I said yes to Charmed. I was told that it wouldn't run for more than 2 seasons, so I may as well sign a standard 5-year contract. I should have realized that it was in other people's money-making interest to do this, but not necessarily mine. Everyone was hoping I'd keep the show on the air and get them to their ultimate money-making goal, the holy grail known as syndication. That's a hell of a lot of pressure for someone who had only been in indie films. I now had 150 crew members' jobs to think about. Believe me, it factored into a lot of my decisions. For the next 5 years, I was my character, Paige Matthews, more than I got to be myself. Paige Matthews was half-sister to the Hallowells, Phoebe, played by Alyssa Milano, and Piper, played by Holly Marie Combs. Alyssa Milano I'd known about because of her show, Who's the Boss, which I was a fan of when I was small. I was somewhat surprised to find myself in a world where we were together. We were so totally different. Her, raised as a wealthy child actress, and me, the scrappy weirdo. There definitely could have been drama on the set, but I refused to take part in it. The press was salivating at the idea of juicy tabloid stories coming from our set, but I refused to oblige. My interest in the job was purely mercenary, so I opted out of infighting. I refused to play games that were beneath me, but it didn't stop the constant watching of our set. I cannot tell you how many times I was asked if we, the charmed ones, hung out after work. The answer was no. The one free hour I had when I went home for the night, I tried to spend with myself. I channeled my efforts into playing Paige, a lovely character, but very much a character. A girl who grew up into a woman on the show. Meanwhile, my own growth as a woman was stunted because of it. I had so many life milestones on camera instead of in real life. My first wedding was a very meta experience. I walked down the aisle with a fake dad, with fake friends, fake sisters, a fake husband-to-be, a fake pastor. It was all fake, fake, fake. I went through the emotions as if it was really happening to me, because that's what acting is, after all. It was particularly